You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and down.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that shout by the Ozzy Brothers, recorded on this day in 1959. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm glad you all can join us this hour. We are privileged to have on our show again today. We have not talked to him since his last book, is Dr. William Julius Wilson, who many regard as America's greatest sociologist. He's a professor at Harvard University, written incredible books like The Declining Significance of Race, The Truly Disadvantaged, and When Work Disappears, The New World of the Urban Poor. I think was his last time that we spoke with him was for that book. His latest book is Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. And Dr. William Julius Wilson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. And I would like to correct the title, More Than Just Race.
More Than Just Race. I have it right in front of me and just misread it. I apologize.
You all can join. To be on your show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation or write to us here at thesteinershow@gmail.com. Dr. Wilson, this is just a really important book to come at this moment, I think. And I was taken with the whole Moynihan report that America made so much of. Of course, I'm talking about the Negro Family, the Case for National Action. And there was a quote that one of your reviewers put in his review of your book, and he asked the question, who made this observation? At the heart of the deterioration of the fabric of Black America is the deterioration of the Black family. It's the fundamental weakness of Black Americans at the present time, and you replace the word Black with Negro, and that comes from that time in 1965, out of that report that's become known as the Moynihan Report. But it was a prescient report, and in many ways provides some of the subtext for your book, I think.
Yes, that report was a very prophetic. Moynihan talked about the breakdown of the poor Black family, and he made a distinction between the poor Black family and middle-class Black families. He says the poor Black family is really suffering. Middle-class Black families are experiencing improvement. But he also talked about the factors that have contributed to the breakdown of the family, racial factors and changes in the economy and the legacy of slavery and so on.
Now, I remember as a young civil rights worker in 1965 that I, along with many other of my peers at that moment, vilified this book, vilified Daniel Moynihan at that time.
Yeah.
The conservatives latched onto the book to use it to kind of attack programs that President Johnson was trying to create, even though the book helped those programs. And straighten our history out and that perspective out for us.
You know, it's really interesting that Moynihan wrote the speech that President Johnson drafted, the speech that President Johnson gave in 1965, his famous civil rights speech at Howard University. And Black leaders praised that speech as a very important one to advance the cause of civil rights. And that speech was really sort of drawn from the Moynihan Report. And the reason that the report was so controversial is because the discussions of the report following its release were distorted. And people selected parts of the report and did not emphasize other parts. And so his discussion of what he calls the social pathologies in the inner city associated with the breakdown of the family were uncoupled. His discussion of that was uncoupled from his more comprehensive analysis of some of the structural forces that have created these problems.
And if there is an intellectual subtext to everything you've written in this book, it is your effort here, where all the research has been done over the years that you've been studying, is to recouple structural analysis with cultural analysis when we look at what's causing the degradation of so many African Americans who are mired in poverty.
Yeah, you see, the purpose of More Than Just Race, my book More Than Just Race, was to prompt social scientists to expand their vision on the factors that contribute to racial inequality in the United States. and thereby, you know, to examine, re-examine the way they discuss these two important factors associated with racial inequality: social structural forces, ranging from those that are racial, such as segregation and discrimination, to those that are non-racial, such as impersonal changes in the economy, and cultural forces that emerge in settings created by discrimination and segregation. What do I mean by cultural forces? Shared outlooks, belief systems, values, skills, styles of presentation, linguistic patterns that emerge in settings created by discrimination and segregation. And what I try to do in the book is develop a framework that, as you point out, that integrates structural and cultural forces. And I must also emphasize that not only do I show how the two are inextricably linked, but I also attempt to explain why structural forces should receive far more attention than cultural forces in accounting for the social outcomes of poor African Americans, and also in framing public policies to address racial inequality.
So, I want to get to those last two points here within the half an hour we have with you, but I do want to kind of talk about what this book may launch, because one of the things that you think about and is that the Moynihan Report itself kind of put a damper, a chill on this kind of research for such a long time. You're kind of reopening a discussion that we've seen the public vilification of people like Bill Cosby or the discussions that has created leading up to Barack Obama's speech on race. And America maybe now is finally coming to a time where we can look at this in an honest way, in an intellectual way, and maybe come to some answers.
Yes, I think the timing of my book couldn't be better, because, you know, Barack Obama also talked about structural and cultural forces and how they are interrelated in his famous speech on race. And he pointed out that Americans must understand the structural forces that have created poverty in the inner cities and created unfortunate responses to poverty, and those are the cultural factors. So he analyzed the legacy of discrimination and segregation, and he also talked about the responses to chronic economic and racial subordination, responses that sometimes reinforce disadvantage. And so here you have the President of the United States highlighting these points, and most people now appreciate the importance of recognizing the integration of these two forces. The problem that Bill Cosby experienced is that he uncoupled, unlike Obama, he uncoupled the cultural responses from the structural forces. And that's why I think he's been sharply criticized. He didn't bring in the structural forces that are so important to understand.
Now, before I ask you questions about how the structural beget the cultural issues that we're facing in America today, because I really want to make that coupling in a minute, but I'd like you to take us back to your writing and your thinking, and even in this book, about what happened around the period of the late 60s through the early 70s that allowed such a large middle class, black middle class, to develop, and why so many in the African-American community remain mired, but in a worse way than has been for generations, in poverty.
Yes. I talk in the book about the combined impact of some of these structural factors that I outlined in the book. A number of structural forces have adversely impacted inner-city black neighborhoods. And these include political actions that were explicitly racial, as well as impersonal economic forces. And one of the combined impacts of these factors was the emergence of depopulated ghettos, especially in cities of the Midwest and Northeast, including Baltimore. Federal transportation and highway policy, along with mortgage interest tax exemptions, jointly facilitated the exodus of both industries and non-poor families from many inner-city neighborhoods, and in turn, the decline of industrial employment in the inner city brought about the end of the second great migration from the South to the North. So you no longer had poor blacks from the South moving to the North to replenish, the vacancies created by those who were leaving. And you also had the out-migration of higher-income of blacks. And this led to the creation of depopulated ghettos as symbolized by or characterized by vacant lots, abandoned buildings. I think in Baltimore you may have as many as 40,000 abandoned.
At least 40,000 abandoned buildings is a huge subject here.
Right.
Huge issue.
So these developments helped to transform many poor black neighborhoods from densely packed areas of recently arrived migrants from the South to neighborhoods gradually abandoned by the working and middle classes. If someone were to sort of, who had been in the Baltimore inner cities in 1960 and been away for a long time and came back, they would be shocked by the changes that have occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, okay, so if we have the deindustrialization of urban America.
Yes.
Coupled with a rise in immigration.
Yes.
Everybody fighting, as you've been writing about, for these service jobs that are left in the inner city. That also is kind of then coupled with a social and welfare policy that kind of, as Moynihan wrote, that almost forced the disintegration of poor families. I mean, this is a perfect storm that has created, in some ways, what we see in the inner cities.
Yeah, I mean, there are just any combination of factors that you can talk about. The issues are very complex, and it's very dispiriting for me to see the sort of simplistic analysis that we can just simply talk about people lacking initiative and motivation.
So talk about how what we do about that, though. I mean, you know, if these are the factors that kind of created it, and they were these kind of mushrooming factors that you almost couldn't control unless you had a vastly different kind of set of social and economic policies in place 40 years ago, which we do not and don't have them in place today. But now we've seen 40-some years of the disintegration, almost 50 years of disintegration of African-American families in the inner city and of the education system and of more. And this is a crisis.
Yes, it is a crisis. And I'm so pleased that we have a president who recognizes the crisis and is supporting programs to address them. For example, he's called for the creation of 20 promised neighborhoods patterned after the Harlem Children's Zone. I don't
right.
know how many of your listeners know about the Harlem Children's Zone, but this zone was featured in a program on 60 Minutes. Jeffrey Canada, the visionary Jeffrey Canada, black leader in Harlem, created the Harlem Children's Zone, and his design was to flood a number of blocks in Harlem with educational, social, and medical services. In other words, to create a comprehensive safety net for the children in the area. And I tell you, the results of this program are just spectacular. The Harlem Children's Zone reaches about 4,000 parents and about 7,500 adults, covers about 100 blocks in Harlem. And it includes, in addition to all these services, a public charter school that differs from regular public schools in a sense that the teachers were selected on the basis of their ability to teach these students and on their dedication, not whether they got a degree from a school of education. But to cut to the chase, here are students from some of the most disadvantaged families and neighborhoods with scores on cognitive tests, verbal scores and math scores in 2007, actually 2008, that matched the scores of kids in white upper middle class suburbia. For example, of the kids in the third grade who benefited from entering the program when they were in kindergarten, 100% scored at or above grade level in math in 2007. And 87% of the students in the eighth grade scored at or above grade level in math, even though they did not have the benefit of early exposure to the charter school. Now, to repeat, here are students from some of the most impoverished backgrounds performing as well in math as those kids in upper middle class suburbia. And they also, you know, done quite well with the verbal scores, but the results are not quite as spectacular. But this is a very, very comprehensive program, and Obama is going to replicate it in 20 cities across the country. And I think if you can demonstrate to the American people that you could create programs for people to help themselves, and if these programs work, I think American people will support them, because the Americans support the idea of a level playing field. And I can't think of a better level playing field than the Harlem Children's Zone, duplicating resources that you find in more privileged neighborhoods.
We're talking with Dr. William Julius Wilson. As many would note, I think the greatest sociologist here in the United States of America, professor at Harvard University. His latest book we're talking about this hour, this half hour, is More Than Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. The
number and I might add that Canada has raised about, his annual budget is roughly $58 million that he's raised through the support from corporate leaders.
And with that, one of the things that they're having a hard time right now in the Harlem Children's Zone, because it is all being done by, most of it's being done by private and charitable contribution. And what if that's going to work in America, you have to have a public policy that makes that the order of the day,
yes,
rather than having to beg for money every year.
Precisely, and that's why I'm pleased that the Obama administration is going to try to replicate this program with federal dollars.
Join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Dr. William Julius Wilson. Your chance to participate in a discussion that doesn't come along often. 410-319-8888. So if you take this proposal you have, and this is the Harlem Children's Zone, and you look at your Chapter 3,
mm-hmm,
which really talks about black men in general, and how they've borne the brunt of changes in the economy more than anybody else.
Yes.
Tie those things together for us.
Well, the problem is that young black men, like low-skilled men in other ethnic groups, have suffered from the decreased relative demand for low-skilled labor, including the computer revolution, which rewards skilled workers and displaces low-skilled workers, and the growing globalization of the economy, where low-skilled workers in this country are competing with low-skilled workers around the world. And black men, years ago, low-skilled black men could find fairly decent jobs in the manufacturing sector, but deindustrialization, with industries moving out to the suburbs and being relocated to cheaper labor areas overseas, have hurt black men more than any other groups. They have borne the brunt of deindustrialization, because a higher percentage of black workers were displaced by deindustrialization than white workers. And so these changes create a situation where low-skilled black men have to now compete with the growing number of immigrants and the women who have entered the labor market in the low in the low-paying service sector. And employers tend, if they have a surplus, tend to hire the immigrants and women first. Black men are chosen last for these jobs.
So
the only time that black men benefit in this economy is when we have a situation like we had in the late 1990s, where we had a tight labor market, as a labor market where employers were looking for workers instead of workers looking for employers. We had very, very low unemployment rates. And this led to a sharp increase in the number of young black men who found jobs.
Dr. Wilson, we're going to open the phones here as we talk with William Julius Wilson. Latest book, More Than Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And James in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, James, we can. You're on the air.
I would like to know this program that he mentioned in the column of the New York. Certainly the areas of Baltimore, especially West Baltimore, as far as what good would it really do as of right now, aiming at a lot of this gang activity that's been going on, as per se. I mean, because when I was coming up, we had a lot of recreational centers and, you know, other youth programs. You had the pool going and...
Right.
And it was a lot of... kids had a lot of things to do besides go hang out on the corner and get into gangbangers or the fights and stuff like that. They really didn't have a lot of that going on in the 70s and the 60s.
Yeah, gangs breed in areas that are deteriorating. You don't find gangs flourishing in areas that are stable and strong. Areas where the major institutions are strong and viable. And the inner city is a lot weaker now. You see, in previous years, and I wrote about this in my book, When Work Disappears.
Yes, you did.
People were poor, but they were working, you see. Now we have a lot of people who are poor and jobless. And a neighborhood in which people are poor and jobless is a much more dangerous neighborhood than one where people are poor and working. And so we've gone from the working poor to the jobless poor. And when you have that situation, it's a breeding ground for gangs, gang formation.
Let's try having another caller, 410-319-8888. Michael in Baltimore, you're on the air.
When I grew up in Baltimore, been in Baltimore all my life, I'm 57, and... During the 60s and early 70s, it was like a transformation from a progressive black neighborhood to to almost nothing. You know, of course, we lost a lot of employment, you know, like General Motors, Bethlehem Steel, some of the chemical companies, Western Electric. But we always had a recreation in parks for the kids to go to all summer long. In fact, these jobs, these community centers would employ people from the neighborhood.
Right.
People had pride in the neighborhood. No longer there anymore. There's nothing for kids to do but get join a gang or hang out on the corners. Of course, we don't want that. We don't even have Little League, you know, football, baseball. We did have that for a while, but I don't see it. I know there is some Little League, but kids aren't interested. Maybe our educational programs have to change to adapt to the children, not adapt to economics, but adapt to the children so that they can be interested in what they do, from the worst student to the best student.
Thank you for your thoughts. And could you hear that one, Dr. Wilson?
Yes, I agree with everything that gentleman was saying. And again, one of the important points to say about the Harlem Children's Zone is that it provides the resources that kids need. A lot of these resources that were quite prevalent in these communities years ago.
And I, this might be a perfect time, the last two callers that came in before we go to our next caller, William Julius Wilson, to talk about the connections. People are making connections here from their own lives about how different it was from in the late 60s and early 70s, where you see the beginning of the breakdown taking place. And to kind of for you to tie in for our listeners how the structural issues we face. Analysis affects the culture we face, create the culture we have today. That tie-in is so little understood, I think.
Yeah, well, let me just say, first of all, you had federal transportation and highway policies that helped shift jobs from the cities to the suburbs. And actually, a lot of manufacturers realized that they're cheaper labor costs in the suburbs. Then you had mortgage interest tax exemptions and mortgage interest tax exemptions for developers and mortgages for veterans that jointly facilitated the out-migration of working and middle-class families from the inner-city neighborhoods to other neighborhoods. And then you had, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution, increasing the opportunity for trained and educated blacks who were able to leave these neighborhoods. All of that happening at the that facilitated the exodus of industry and families. That was happening at the same time there was a succession of migration from the South to the North. The Great Migration from the South to the North ended around 1970. So you don't have any new migrants flowing in like you do in a Mexican community or the Latino community. You didn't have any new migrants flowing in after 1970, and you had a higher income groups leaving these areas and industries leaving these areas, leaving behind a higher percentage of people who are poor and jobless. To repeat, from densely packed areas of recently arrived migrants from the South to neighborhoods that are gradually abandoned by the working and middle classes.
And do you think those were larger factors than the question of the deindustrialization of...
Well, those factors only relate to the change of neighborhoods that a lot of your callers seem to be describing.
Right, right.
Right. Deindustrialization certainly contributes to the joblessness in the area, in these inner city areas. But I was trying to explain this incredible transformation in inner city neighborhoods from vibrant, densely packed areas where there's people were poor but working to areas that have been abandoned, and you have vacant lots and abandoned buildings and extremely high levels of joblessness.
And your book also tackles how globalization has really affected poor African-American communities more than any other in America, just about.
Well, what I think that globalization has shifted a lot of jobs that African-Americans, especially black males, depended on. And a lot of these jobs now are in cheaper labor areas overseas. And that's why I said that black workers in this country are competing not only with other workers, poor black workers competing with other workers in this country, but with low-skilled labor around the world.
Dr. William Julius Wilson, it's been an honor and pleasure to talk to you once again. As always, wish we had you for a whole hour. Well, at least we had you for half an hour. I hope we can talk to you again at some time soon.
Thank you. My pleasure, sir.
Lovely to have you with us.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. William Julius Wilson has been our guest. The book, More Than Just Race, Being Black and Poor in the Inner City, is the book.
You're listening to a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. We're about to take a very brief break and coming right back with more. But right now we're here in Birdland by Weather Report. Ayrton Morea of Weather Report, born on this day in 1941.